The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme, 100 years of dentistry in Ireland.
From the late 1940s, the state really starts to take a strong interest in providing public dental health services.
We'll hear how the dental profession changed and evolved over the last century. Also,
take the administration that was already in place under the British. Cosgrave, for example, had been on the Dublin Corporation since 1909. They pretty much kept the things alive that they were familiar with, which makes a lot of sense. That was the government that they knew.
What changed and what remained the same when Ireland became an independent nation? Joseph E. A. Connell joins me to talk about the Anglo-Irish Treaty, the 1922 Constitution, and how independence affected the lives of ordinary citizens in the Irish Free State. Plus, the story of two powerful men separated by centuries but connected by their love of art.
With the arrival of Cromwell, Bishop Walter had to flee Galway to Europe, where he eventually found himself in Hungary. One of the items he arrived with was a painting of the Madonna and Child.
Ronan Kelly on the stories of Bishops Walter Lynch and Padraig O'Donoghue. Dentistry, like any branch of medicine, is an evolving profession, constantly adapting to new technologies, scientific advancements and societal needs. During the first century of Ireland's independence, dentists have advocated for better oral health and supported efforts to improve the art and science of dentistry. This story is explored in a recently published book, The Irish Dental Association, A Centenary History. I'm joined by the authors, Dr. Owen Kinsella from the Royal Irish Academy and Dr. Francis Nolan from the School of History at University College Dublin. You're both very welcome indeed to The History Show.
Thank you.
Francis, talk to us a bit about how dentistry was becoming professionalised in the late 19th century in Ireland.
Yeah, well, historically, dentistry was actually carried on as a trade, often through generations of particular families. But the professionalisation of the field occurs from the middle of the 19th century, and it's fuelled really by a Victorian enthusiasm for scientific research and for regulation. So it comes about really through a number of key developments, and these include the award of qualifications in dentistry by universities, the establishment of dental hospitals to provide training and improve professional standards, the introduction of legislation then as well with the 1878 Dental Act, and then the formation of a professional body, which was the British Dental Association in 1880.
And where had we come from, Owen? What had preceded this professionalisation? Some pretty barbaric treatments, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the word that we would come across quite a lot was quackery, to refer to the kinds of practices that went on. And that's not to diminish the legitimate trade that was being practiced, but there was a lot of people who were practicing dentistry who didn't have any qualifications, even after the qualifications began to be introduced. And I think that's kind of a key point of what Francis is talking about there in terms of the professionalisation and kind of the standardisation of the different practices that dentists would go through. And one of the main reasons the BDA was set up, the British Dental Association, which forms an Irish branch later on, of course, is to monitor the profession to make sure that standards are being kept up to the regulations that are put in place. And, you know, one of the ones that we came across in our research was a report on a person masquerading as a dentist in Cork. I think this is 1905 or 1906, and there's a report he's charged with manslaughter because he pulled six teeth from an 18-year-old girl's mouth and she bleeds to death. And that's the kind of thing that I suppose the regularisation and the professionalisation of dentistry was supposed to stamp out. And the IDA would have been to the fore, or sort of the Irish branch of the BDA would have been to the fore in early efforts to stamp that kind of practice out and get rid of people like that from practising dentistry.
So, Francis, you mentioned the British Dental Association. Mm-hmm. That comes about in 1887. When does the Irish Dental Association happen, and at what point does it separate itself from the British Dental Association?
Yeah, so the Irish branch, the BDA itself is established in 1880, and then 7 years later, Irish members of that association established the Irish branch. And really then it's in existence for 25 years up until the point of the formation of the Free State, at which point then the Irish Dental Association is formed. And as Owen mentioned there, much of their energy during that time is given over to combating quackery. And this is done kind of by increasing the number of qualified dentists, improving standards and training and education. So that's very much their focus, I think, for their lifespan.
And I think that the Irish Dental Association or Irish dentists would have tended to have been overwhelmingly Protestant and perhaps Unionist. And that causes problems in 1922. I mean, there's almost a split, almost like Brendan Behan, the first thing on the agenda.
Yeah, well, it's interesting with the IDA. I think, you know, the move to establish the association is actually a decisive response to an altered political reality. So it's actually only a number of weeks kind of after the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty that you have the Irish branch moving to establish an Irish Dental Association. They send out a letter to members announcing their intention to do so. And that's because they recognised, regardless of religion, you know, they recognised that a new body would be needed to operate in a new jurisdiction, which was the Irish Free State. So it made practical sense, but it was also kind of a bold move by a professional body, which were socially and socially and politically rather conservative at this time. And, you know, it's worth, I think, kind of comparing it to the Irish branch of the British Medical Association, which actually stays in existence until the 1930s. So it's quite a bold move, as I've said, to do so.
But there are tensions about whether or not you should propose a toast to the king in 1922.
Yes, absolutely. So it is, I mean, they, given that it's a very fraught political climate, it's actually a pretty amicable setup process for the Irish Dental Association. You know, there is talk at one point of establishing an all-Ireland body. This doesn't come to fruition, and subsequently then a Northern Irish branch of the British Dental Association is formed. So that would give the impression, I think, at least initially, that political concerns are trumped by professional concerns. But that's obviously not the case in Ireland in the early 1920s, rather. And then with that, what you see at the Irish Dental Association annual dinner in 1923 is the decision to include a toast to King George VI results in a quick split in the association. Straight after the dinner, about 50 dentists sign a letter protesting the toast. Subsequently then, six members of the anti-toast faction infiltrate the board of the association.
The anti-toast faction.
Yes, yes. They infiltrate the council, and they attempt then to dissolve the Irish Dental Association and replace it with the Irish Free State Dental Association.
Yeah, and it's probably worth pointing out that the toast was there because it was proposed because members of the British Dental Association were in attendance at the dinner, as yes. was Tim Healy, the Governor General of the Free State. And, you know, it was to, I suppose it was to a court tradition as well. They'd always had that tradition there, and there was no view that this would be a political problem. And they solved it fairly amicably, I think, as well. And it is probably worth saying as well that this secession from the British Dental Association, it's very amicable. There's no issue with it whatsoever. And as Francis said, they're the only medical professional organisation in Ireland to actually take this step of setting up an independent association, independent from its British parent association, if you like. And that's a really interesting development, and it's something that's kind of glossed over a little bit.
And one of their jobs, obviously, is to represent their members, but also the Irish Dental Association is lobbying the government from the 1920s onwards for better policies in relation to dentistry and social healthcare in general.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's for the first two decades maybe of its existence, the IDA's main focus is on improving dental standards, improving dental policies, but also in terms of bringing in the legislation necessary to, I suppose, to regulate the profession. And that's part of the whole process of forming a new state that sometimes is forgotten about, is what kind of legislation is in place. And all dentists who practice in Ireland had to register on what was called the Dental Register. That was run by the British Medical Council. And under legislation from 1921, which obviously was passed by a parliament in Westminster. So there's a question then from 1922 onwards, what legislation governs dentistry in Ireland? And the answer is none. So there's huge problems in terms of actually trying to get a professionalisation and a regularisation of the profession of dentistry from that point onwards. And it's not until 1928 that legislation is actually enacted by the Iraq District. So there's a 6-year delay there, which leads to this kind of resurgence almost of quackery, again, to use that term, of people beginning to practice, trying to practice, who don't have the qualifications in place. So 1928 is when we have the Dentist Act that sets up an Irish Dental Register, which is first published in 1930. And there's 553 dentists listed on that at that time in 1930. And it's the first piece of legislation brought into place for dentistry. And it's another 60 years before updated legislation was brought in. And you can imagine how outdated the 1928 Act was by 1985 when that piece of legislation was brought in.
Indeed. And things do begin to improve. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, even in the 1940s, things were still pretty grim. One of the presidents of the IDA, a man called J.B. Moorhead, describes some of the things that he encounters in his practice. Owen?
Yeah, it was J.B. Moorhead. He was the president of the Irish Dental Association. And at his his dinner, at the dinner, at their annual dinner, he talked about the conditions that faced the public dental officers. So these were people who were working for the public service, because you have two classes of dentists in Ireland. You have those who are working in private practice and those who are working in public practice. So he's the chairman also of the public dental officers group. And he describes an event when he's in a parochial hall, which he says is no more than a converted stable. This is in the mid-1940s, and he's trying to treat children, trying to treat people under the public dental scheme, and he's sterilising instruments over a fire that's fed by ashes. And he says that by the end of the day, he's using water that's like gruel. It's as thick,
this is a
thick
turf
with ashes.
Fire,
it's a turf fire, exactly, a turf fire. And he says that's the kind of, I suppose, those are the kinds of standards, and those are the facilities that they had in place, and they were nowhere near what was needed. And there was also far too few public dental officers working in the state as well for the population.
Very surprised I was to discover that actually Ireland was one of the first countries to introduce fluoride to water.
Yeah.
Just explain the background to fluoridation, if you would.
Yeah,
how got involved so quickly.
It kind of, I suppose it spreads from the belief within dentistry, and it's always been a huge part of dental practice in Ireland, is that prevention is much better than remediation. So the idea was that in the late 1940s and in the early 1950s, there was emerging research to show that by putting fluoride in the water, it would decrease the number of dental cavities you would find in children, and as well as that, obviously, then in future years in adults. And the IDA were really, really strong supporters of that research from a very, very early time. And one of their very heavily involved member, Seamus McNeill, he's appointed as the state's very first dental advisory officer in the Department of Health in 1952. And he gets the chief medical officer support to set up the Fluorine Consultative Council in 1956. That has the dentists on that are all members of the IDA. Their report is issued in 1958 to say it's a very good idea if we put fluoride in the water supply of the entire country. It's a huge step, and no other country in the world had made that decision yet. You'd had, like in Grand Rapids in Michigan, you'd had the fluoridation of a local water supply. You'd had similar things in the UK as well, but there'd never been a move around the world to put fluoride in the entire nation's water supply. So that leads to...
Conspiracy theories, I'm sure.
Is one way to put it, yeah. And there's a couple of groups, but there's a few groups that oppose this idea. There's one called the Pure Water Association, which is actually an offshoot of another group which had pre-existed called the Soil Association. And the Pure Water Association asks the Department of Health, can they be on the Fluorine Consultative Council to give its input? But the feedback that they get from the Department of Agriculture is that the Soil Association and ergo the Pure Water Association are a bunch of cranks, so they don't get to have their say. But there is very, very consistent and very concerted opposition, and it's funded as well from externally. So there's an external funding coming in from the US, and the IDA end up reaching out to their American counterparts, the American Dental Association, and asking for them for tips and support on how to combat this misinformation. So they draw up a pamphlet or a leaflet with help from the American Dental Association to counteract that kind of narrative.
And there's religious opposition as well, something called the League of the Kingship of Christ.
That's right, and Riaguk, yeah, they were one of the other three main, the other main group opposing it. So there was opposition coming from all across the board, but what Sean Lamass did, and what the government at the time did, was they went to the Irish bishops and they asked for their advice, and they said that there was no ethical objections to doing this. So that kind of brought, I think, anybody who might have had a religious objection mostly back on side.
Now, the IDA represents private dentists and publicly employed dentists. Is there not a conflict there? Is there tension, or was there historically tension there?
Yeah, it's something that they've managed remarkably well, given that both sides of those that divide sometimes are very different and very competing priorities. And it's something that really the IDA had to pivot towards, including within its remit from the late 1940s onwards. And it's only from the late 1940s that the state really starts to take a strong interest in providing public dental health services. That accelerates from 1970 onwards, but really it's with the National Health Insurance Scheme in the 1940s. And at the time, the IDA was very strongly opposed to the idea that there would be any kind of state benefit scheme put in place, because they thought that this would take away from the earning power of their members. And at the time, the public dental officers were a very small minority within the IDA's membership number. So that, I think, it must have been very, very difficult for them. There's no real overt, the records aren't there to show what kind of tensions there might have been between them and the private practice. But I think it must have been a bit of an issue for them. The solution in some ways was for the IDA to come on board with the idea of a public dental health system by advocating for its private practice members to fill the gap where there weren't enough public dental officers. The private members would see publicly funded patients and be reimbursed by the government. And that's the kind of the beginnings of the system that we have in place now, where you can go to see your dentist and get your dental treatments under your PRSI scheme or whichever one it is.
Francis, at the end of the book, you've got a section called Operatory Lights, which covers some very interesting stories that don't fit into the broader narrative of the book. Let's hear a few of those stories now. One of them, for example, is the story of the first woman to formally qualify as a dentist in Ireland. Tell me about her.
Yeah, well, I suppose the first thing to say is professionalisation has the unfortunate effect of excluding women from dentistry. Historically, they had practised dentistry when it was carried on as a trade, often as part of a family business. So with professionalisation, then the door is closed effectively on women for a number of years. So it's not until 1895 that the first woman, she's an English woman named Lillian Lindsay, actually became the first in Britain or Ireland to graduate, to qualify as a professional dentist. And she graduated from the Edinburgh Dental Hospital and School. And Lindsay had actually previously applied the London Dental Hospital, but was unsuccessful after she was forced as well to interview on the steps outside the building because the dean of the school was afraid that she'd distract all the male students inside. So there were considerable barriers to women practising in the profession. But following Lindsay's example then, Mary DeSales McGuinness, who was born in Lurgan in Armagh and came from a medical family, she became the first woman to qualify as a dentist in Ireland when she graduated with a Bachelor in Dental Science from Trinity in 1908. And that was just 4 years after women were first allowed to enter the university. But McGuinness would kind of later reflect on her experience in Trinity and to some extent echo Lindsay's experience by recalling that women weren't actually permitted to sit with men in lectures. They weren't permitted to speak to men in the college park. And they also obviously had to dress with sufficient modesty. And she's pulled up on the fact that she hasn't dressed with sufficient modesty and advised to preserve a strict college attitude then at one point as well. So it wasn't an easy path for McGuinness or for other women, I think, entering a university at that time. But she obviously continues on and graduates then.
And then how did the public react to her?
Well, she actually works then in kind of a public-facing role with the Women's Health Association.
Yeah.
And she encounters obviously public members of the public at that stage. And she said that most people were absolutely happy to be treated by a woman, but that she encountered a number of men who were sceptical, at least to say the least at first. So not always the easiest to convince.
There's also a section on dentists in the 1916 Rising. You've profiled a few people who got caught up in the rebellion with tragic consequences. Tell us about Charles Hachette Highland.
Yeah, well, Highland is an interesting case. He lives in and around Mount Street. So, when the Battle of Mount Street occurs during the Rising, he's right on the front lines and he actually treats the wounded in that area. But following on from that, then tragically, he looks out his back door one evening and is caught by a stray bullet then in the fighting. So he is one of a handful, I think, of casualties with Irish dentists. So another one then, probably the most prominent, is a man named John O'Duffy, who was really a kind of really important early reformer within the Irish branch of the British Dental Association. And he's also then a co-founder of the Dublin Dental Hospital. But he's a major figure. He lives on the north side of the city near the Rotunda. And he's actually shot then in the crossfire on Sackville Street again. And he actually is the senior member of a prominent family of dentists in Dublin. His son, Kevin, is the president of the Irish branch. He's also a committed imperialist and a home ruler. And he's also surgeon dentist to the Lord Lieutenant, Lord Aberdeen. And the O'Duffys are a really interesting family, I think, because they demonstrate, I suppose, some of the divisions that were evident in Irish society at this time. So Kevin O'Duffy's son, Aymar, he's actually a committed nationalist and socialist. So while his father implores with him to join the British Army on the outbreak of the First World War, he refuses. He becomes obviously a member of the IRB and also the Irish Volunteers. And he has a very important role in the 1916 Rising then, because Aymar O'Duffy, along with Bulmer Hobson, go and warn Owen McNeill about plans for the Rising. And McNeill then obviously issues his countermanding order to cancel the rebellion.
Well, the book is called The Irish Dental Association, A Centenary History. It's published by Eastwood Books. And my guests are the authors Owen Kinsella and Francis Nolan. Thank you both very much for joining us this evening.
Thanks, Miles. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
After the break, Joseph E. A. Connell joins me to talk about the 1922 Constitution, partition, and how independence affected the lives of ordinary citizens in the Irish Free State. Stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
As we move on from the decade of centenaries, my next guest is now turning his sights on the transition to and development of the new Irish state. I'm joined by Joseph E.A. Connell, visiting us here in studio this week from his home in the USA. He's the author of many books on subjects like the Easter Rising, the War of Independence, and the intelligence network of Michael Collins. And as we've discussed with Joe before on this show, his background in the US Armed Forces informs his analysis of all these aspects of the Irish Revolutionary period. Joe, you're very, very welcome back indeed.
Thank you so much, Miles. Thank you.
Now, since last time we spoke, a number of centenaries have come and gone towards the end of the decade of centenaries, not least of which was the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty. I have to ask, do you think the treaty was a good deal for the Irish?
I think when one looks at the negotiating tactics of the Irish and the negotiating tactics of the British, I think the Irish got probably all they could have expected to get out of the negotiations. Remember, we think very often in terms of what did the Irish get, what didn't the Irish get. But the British themselves, the British negotiators, had limitations upon what they could give as well. It was very important to their party that they could only do so much. And also remember that Lloyd George led a coalition cabinet. He led a coalition government. So there were liberals on the negotiating side for the British, but there were also conservatives on the negotiating side for the British. And one thing that we forget then, and we forget it now, is the official name of the Conservative Party was the Conservative and Unionist Party. And we forget that there was a lot of pressure on them from the Unionists. So yes, in fact, overall, I think the Irish got a fairly good deal and got probably all they could have expected.
Particularly because... well, there was no real united front. There are many of the leaders of what was supposed to be a united Sinn Féin actually wanted very different things, even a monarchy.
You mentioned the fact that I was in the military, but I spent most of my working life as a lawyer. One of the things I did as a lawyer is I did a lot of negotiation. And you always have to establish, I was the agent, of course, working for a principal, working for my client. You always have to establish exactly what the parameters of your negotiation tactics are going to be. The Irish never did that. You're right. They went anywhere from a monarchy to a socialist republic. Was the Dominion going to be okay? When De Valera went and talked to Lloyd George in July after the truce, they knew they were not going to get a republic. I think if they made a mistake with regard to that, and they made many, but one of the biggest mistakes was they didn't inform the people here at home exactly what was going to be possible. So the people were not understanding, were very misinformed about what they could possibly get out of the negotiations.
Well, they certainly didn't inform Cottle Brew and Austin Stack of what was possible.
Well, I was just going to say they may have informed, but particularly of those two, they didn't convince them.
Didn't want to know about it. You've been giving lectures recently touching on the theme of whether or not there was a social shift in Ireland after the War of Independence. What do you mean by social shift?
Well, again, I think when you take a look at some of the writings of the people around the time of the Rising and later on, Felix Larkin, for example, the son of James Larkin, said there was, in fact, a revolution in Ireland, but it came before the War of Independence. It came from the Land League, the times of the 1800s and moving into it. There was a man named Vincent Gookin, who was a surveyor in Ireland in the 17th century, and he had a very interesting quotation. He said that the breaking down of a country is very easy, but the establishment of a country is not. If we take a look at the period after 1923, for example, I wonder how much the worker at Jacobs, how much the docker, how much the fisher person, how much the person living in a tenement, how much did their life really change? It probably didn't change very much. There were 800,000 people in tenements in Ireland in 1923. How much did their life change? So I'm not sure there was a social shift. There was certainly a political shift. You were going to pay rates and you were going to pay taxes and it was going to go to an Irish government. But I'm not sure there was a social shift for anyone who was involved in that. And that, as you suggested a few minutes ago, that created problems for those who wanted a socialist republic. That was not going to be available to them.
Yeah, I mean, there was no social shift like the one that James Connolly, the deceased James Connolly, would have wanted, or the very much alive Pather O'Donnell, for example, would have wanted.
Absolutely. Pather O'Donnell, for example, wrote about it before he was executed. Liam Mellows wrote about it. So there were individuals. But one of the problems I think they had is that those who really wanted more of a socialist shift were not as enthusiastic or were not as knowledgeable about the need for administration and for putting this into effect, whereas some of the others who did not want a social shift came from the Dublin Corporation and moved into those positions in the new government. So they were very satisfied with the government they had, but it was not a different government. It was pretty much the same. That's why I think O'Donnell was the one who coined the term, it was a revolution without a revolution.
He also suggested that it was, in fact, a counter-revolution, Father O'Donnell. Well, are we talking really? The metaphor was they just painted the post boxes green. Is that what we're talking about?
To some degree, yes, I think it is. Again, you've got Kevin O'Higgins, who had the very famous quotation that there were eight men standing in the ruins of one administration, starting a new administration with the raging mob outside shouting through the keyhole. And if one looks at it and says, that's really not exactly what happened, they did in fact take the administration that was already in place under the British. Cosgrave, for example, had been on the Dublin Corporation since 1909. They pretty much kept the things alive that they were familiar with, which makes a lot of sense. That was the government that they knew. So the fact of the matter is, it's closer to say, I think, that they painted the post boxes than it is to say there was a brand new administration.
And they, one of the first things they had to do was they had to come up with a constitution, which they duly did, the 1922 Irish Free State Constitution. Mm. What did that achieve? What did they try to achieve with it? What did they, for a brief period at least, try to avoid with it?
One of the things about the 1922 Constitution, and I like it very, very much, we'll talk perhaps in a moment or two about the rights that it gave to women, and it was probably the most gender-neutral constitution that Ireland's ever had. But when they were putting it together, Michael Collins was the chairman of the committee, but actually Darrell Figgis was the one who wrote the Constitution, and it was primarily his work. One of the things they tried to do, Collins and even Griffith tried to do, is they tried to push back a little bit on the concessions they made in the negotiation of the Anglo-Irish Treaty. So as they were putting the Constitution together, they were trying to limit the powers of the Crown, limit the powers of the King. And in fact, when they made the first submission of a draft of the Constitution to the British in May, there was no oath of allegiance or oath of loyalty in the Constitution. Well, the British threw this out immediately. Lloyd George said it was really a declaration of a republic without being a republic. And Winston Churchill used the opportunity to taking the Constitution and threatening the Irish in the House of Commons, if you don't change this, you know, we can go back into a war situation. So it was a very important time. It was their first real constitution that they had. There was a constitution and the original meeting of the Doyle in January of 1919, but that was only a 630-word constitution, which is just about the length of the wording on a page of A4. If you think about this, that's a very small constitution. The 1922 constitution had 83 clauses to it, and it was a very important document.
We've been revisiting the 1937 Constitution, obviously, in the last number of months in Ireland. But the 1922 Constitution and its regard for women's rights. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Article 3 of the 1922 Constitution said that any person who is a resident of the Irish nation or Irish island or has been a resident for 7 years is a citizen of the Ireland and gets all of the privileges thereof. Full stop.
Full stop. But that's really not how it worked out, because with, you know, somebody like Kevin O'Higgins, I mean, he made a statement in Dáil Éireann, a few words in the Constitution doesn't wipe out the difference between men and women. And then famously tries to have women excluded from juries in Ireland.
I would go further than say tries. He tried in the 1924 Juries Act, a woman could opt out, and that didn't get enough women off of the jury. So he had a 1927 Juries Act where a woman had to opt in. And this takes advantage of the natural inertia, really, of human beings. If you have to do something, you're probably not going to do it. So it took an awful lot of women off of there. But in fact, you're exactly right. And I've always found that statement by Kevin O'Higgins in the Doyle is very offensive as a lawyer. Remember, he had taken an oath to give full allegiance to the Constitution of the Irish Free State, and to say I'm going to disregard some of the wording in that, to me, was very offensive as a lawyer.
And was it pretty apparent that women were not welcome in politics?
It was very apparent. But in all fairness, I think it has to be said there was something going on at the time that we ignore, perhaps. Remember, all six women who were in the Doyle in terms of the 1922, 1921 period voted against the Constitution. So they might not have been on the very best terms with the government as it came on. But also in 1921, 1922, and 1923, the women from coming them on would go to jurors and say, you will please find against the government here if you're going to get on the IRA. So they very often were out of that. But I definitely think there was an idea to keep women in the home, that they wanted them to look at their domestic situation. And again, Kevin O'Higgins, unfortunately, is very good for a quotation at the time. He basically said that they couldn't be on the jury because it would offend their sensibilities. It didn't offend them enough that they couldn't be charged with a crime, and it didn't offend them enough that they couldn't act as a witness, but he just simply didn't want them as a juror.
Talk to us then about partition and how the border was finally determined, was finally created.
Partition, I think the Anglo-Irish Treaty gets blamed a lot, unfortunately, for the fact of partition, but partition really came from the Government of Ireland Act of 1921. And when it went to effect in May of 1921, partition was the way that the British got the North off of the table so that they could proceed with negotiations with the South. In fact, if we think in terms of the treaty causing partition, that really reverses cause and effect. The partition was there all along, and this allowed the circumstances to allow the British, the Lloyd George government, to negotiate with the South. It has not changed since that time, but that's how the partition was set up in the Government of Ireland Act, and it didn't change. As far as the border was concerned, there was a clause in the Anglo-Irish Agreement, the 12th article, in which it said there would be a border commission. But it never exactly outlined the terms of that. It said that the border would be established according to the wishes of the people, according to their economic and geographical ideas, but it never exactly defined any of those terms. The Irish, I think, thought that the Border Commission was going to give a lot of property to the South. The British thought that it could be property either way. In fact, when the Border Commission made its determination, they determined that some property would go both directions. It's very important to note that was quite a shock to the South. There was a suggestion made by the Department of Finance that maybe we can do something about this. And in fact, Cosgrave led a delegation over there to Britain. And what they determined was there was another section of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, Section 5, which said that the Irish were to pay for the British war debt in many ways and pensions. That was taken out. The Irish kept the very same border that was established in the Government of Ireland Act, and the border has never changed. It's important to note that the very wording of Cosgrave's statement to the Doyle when he came back was, this will cause great problems, so this agreement should be burned or buried so no one knows what it was. It was buried sufficiently so that no one found out about it until 1969.
There's a wonderful moment in the Hollywood film The Candidate, Robert Redford, where at the very, very end, he's won his campaign, he's won his seat, and he turns to his campaign manager in puzzlement and says, now what are we going to do? Did Michael Collins, do you think, have a Robert Redford moment after the Anglo-Irish Treaty?
The what-ifs are always great conversations, and we've had many of those over the years, and I really enjoy them. Michael Collins was once asked by a visiting American senator, what are you going to do now, exactly as you suggested? What are you going to do now that you've won? And Collins' answer, I think, could be used right now as a prescient answer. He said, if Ireland produces services that the sophisticated markets of the world want, if they do it at the price that they will pay, if they perform in such a way that they give delivery as they want, then that's how Ireland will advance in the future. And if you look at Ireland today, that's kind of what they've done in terms of pharmaceuticals or IT or anything else, or even dairy gold, which is sold all over the United States. This is, in fact, it. But I think if you take that one particular statement and you say, all right, now Michael Collins knows exactly how to run the Free State of Ireland and the Republic of Ireland for the next 100 years, I think that's a little bit of an extension.
Okay, well, let's extend the what if. Had Collins lived, what difference might it have made in an independent Ireland? Would he have been, for example, a more radical force than the Cosgraves and the O'Higginses of this world?
I think he would have been more radical. I'm not sure if he had been radical in terms of socialism. Collins was not a socialist by any means. And I don't think he would have been in that way. It's very hard to tell exactly how far he would have gone or how far he would have proposed to go. But I think he would have provided a great balancing effort to the De Valera, the Finafoil, which came around in 1932 when they were in there. If you got have De Valera goes into office at that point, instead of the Cosgrave, who was really a sort of a gray individual, if you will, if you have more of a dynamic individual like Collins, you might have had a big counterpoint to it. But I'm not sure that you can always say that Collins would have wanted to do so because he had a lot of different interests. He always said he was not a politician. He was a soldier. You and I have spoken in the past about the fact that I think that he was not either a politician or a very good soldier. He was a very, very good international CEO. And I'm not sure he might have gone different directions than being simply in politics in Ireland in the 1930s and thereafter.
Counterfactual history, not exactly rigorous, but great fun. There's no doubt about it. Unfortunately, we won't know the answer to the last couple of questions, but your insights on these questions, always interesting, always valuable. My guest is historian Joseph E.A. Connell. Joe, many thanks indeed for joining us.
Always thank you, Mark. Thank you very much.
After the break, two bishops, two paintings. Ronan Kelly looks at the intersections of art, religion, and personal history in the lives of two men born centuries apart. Stay with us.
The History Show with Miles Dungan on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. We all know that history stories can come at us from all sorts of encounters. In Ronan Kelly's case, he was in casual conversation over lunch with a husband and wife when he heard the stories of two powerful men.
Pete and Sheila weren't exactly competing with their stories, but as I sat there listening to them, I did find myself wondering which of them had the better yarn. It was one of those long summer lunches in the good weather, and the wife and husband were telling stories about Irish bishops and their paintings. Sheila's story was about an Irish bishop who ended up with his painting in Hungary and who died there in 1663. Pete's bishop died only a few years ago. His painting ended up in a nursing home in Mallow. The two bishops were Walter and Padraig. Sheila told us about Walter. She was interrailing around Europe last year and she ended up in the city of Győr in Hungary. She found herself in the local cathedral. To one side of an altar, she came face to face with a painting of the Madonna and Child. Signs beside it explained that it was known to weep in the past. But what caught Sheila's eye was a plaque saying that the painting had been given to the cathedral by an Irishman named Dr. Walter Lynch. I looked up Walter Lynch. He was the son of a Galway merchant and was born around the turn of the 17th century. He was educated in Lisbon and Paris, and having been ordained, he returned home to a prominent position in the church in Galway. He was firmly on the side of anti-English rebels in the mid-1600s, which led Rome to elevate him to bishop, and he swiftly excommunicated those he disagreed with. However, with the arrival of Cromwell, Bishop Walter had to flee Galway to Europe, where he eventually found himself in Hungary, working as an assistant to the bishop in Győr. One of the items he arrived with was a painting of the Madonna and Child. Bishop Lynch stayed in Győr for a few years until conditions for Catholics back home improved. He then got ready to return to Galway. However, he unexpectedly fell ill and died. That was in 1663 on July 14th. Walter Lynch's painting of the Madonna and Child was hung in the cathedral. Then, on St. Patrick's Day in 1697, during Mass, people in the cathedral said that the painting began to weep, either tears or blood. This went on for 2 hours. The liquid was dried with a linen cloth, and that material is now preserved in a silver and glass casket in the cathedral, while the painting is in an elaborate shrine. That's Bishop Walter's painting in the cathedral in Hungary, the Bishop Sheila told us about. The bishop her husband Pete spoke about, Bishop Padraig, his painting ended up in a wardrobe in a nursing home in Mallow. Pete's story was about meeting Bishop Padraig and hearing him tell about his life in the Catholic Church in England. Padraig began life as Padraig O'Donoghue in 1934 in Moran Abbey in County Cork. His parents were farmers. He started his working life in the post office but wanted to become a priest. When he approached his local bishop in 1959, he was told that at 24 he was too old. So Padraig went to the UK, where he was ordained, and eventually ended up working in Westminster Cathedral as assistant to Cardinal Basil Hume. Padraig O'Donoghue loved sprinkling his reminiscences with famous names. For example, one day he was summoned by Basil Hume to entertain a lunch guest who Hume needed to take a break from. When Father Padraig went in, the person he was to keep company was British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Hume was supposed to be only gone for a few minutes, but didn't come back for half an hour. Padraig also mentioned Lady Diana. He'd met her when he was involved in setting up a soup kitchen in London, and when they met afterwards at various functions, they always had a word for each other, according to him. While at Westminster, Father Padraig O'Donoghue was ordained bishop and was eventually assigned to Lancaster, where he was described both as a radical and a fundamentalist. Lancaster Diocese was so heavily in debt, he sold off the bishop's palace and laid off half the diocesan staff. He wrote against the war in Iraq and against politicians stirring up hostility towards asylum seekers, and that was in the run-up to the 2001 British general election, won by another of those he mentioned meeting, Tony Blair. Bishop O'Donoghue also believed that the Catholic Church should be against safe-sex education and adoption by gay couples, and he instructed his schools and parishes accordingly. Padraig O'Donoghue was known familiarly as Pod, although his secretary liked to wind him up by calling him My Lord. Part of his Sunday ritual was to ring back home to Cork to find out how the GAA teams were doing, both Cork County and local Clyde Rovers teams, especially the ladies' football team, which was the pride of the club. Bishop Padraig loved fine furniture and art, and when he retired to Ireland from England, one keepsake, a painting he took with him, was a Russian icon showing the Madonna. It had been given to the Catholic Church in England by a woman who had converted to Catholicism from Judaism, but for insurance reasons, the church didn't want to keep it and gave it to Bishop Padraig. In his final home, a nursing home near Mallow, he liked to open the wardrobe in his room and show the painting to visitors. One of those visitors was Pete, who says it's beautiful. Bishop Walter's Madonna in Hungary, seen by Sheila, has a plaque beside it, paid for by the Irish government. Bishop Padraig's Madonna is, I can't find out where. He died in 2021 and the icon is no longer in the nursing home. Perhaps someday it'll emerge in public with its own plaque and its own story to tell.
And that was Ronan Kelly with the stories of Bishops Walter Lynch and Padraig O'Donoghue, separated by centuries but connected by their power within the Catholic Church and by their love of art. And finally tonight, staying with religion and devotional art, we've asked Dr. Deirdre Ní Chonaille, Associate Research Scholar at Glucksman Ireland House, New York University, to pick an appropriate song to close on tonight. And Deirdre, you've gone with Sean O'Riordan's choral setting of Cuíne na dtrí muire. Tell us about that.
Cuíne na dtrí muire, or Cuíne na páise, it describes the Passion of Christ. It's a traditional channel song, composer unknown, in the form of a lament or a keen. And it's sung for centuries at this stage, usually a solo channel singer. But lately we've had choral versions emerge as well. So Cór Chulé, founded in the 1960s by Sean O'Riordan, sing a beautiful version of this song. Cór Chulé, of course, draws on the channel song tradition in its style and for inspiration in relation to repertoire in particular. People will be familiar with the sung mass, the first sung mass as Gaeilge composed after Vatican II by Sean O'Riordan. Ar an Aithead and Críost an Síol, the hymns from that are sung widely now. But Cuíne na dtrí muire here is one of a handful of songs reserved for special occasions, religious rituals such as funeral services or pilgrimages such as Maumean in Connemara, a spot marked by Cliona Cusson's beautiful sculpture. So in the recording, this recording, you can hear soloists, then the choir follows together with the refrain in a sort of a meditative style, singing O Hon, O Hon, O, My Sorrow, My Sorrow. And you can hear the structure of the song. It's a conversation. The voices are Peter and Mary and Jesus and the soldier. The words are really sort of intense and direct and intimate even, and definitely emotional. The opening starts with, Peter, apostle, have you seen my fair love? And the response is, I saw him earlier being crucified. So it's very evocative of the kind of devotional art that we've just been hearing about.
Deirdre Ní Chonaila, thank you very much indeed. And Deirdre will be giving the opening lecture at the Léachtaí Columcille event at Maynooth University, which is happening on the 12th and 13th of April, the conference theme being the early audio heritage of the Irish language. That's all we've time for this evening's programme. My thanks tonight to Liam Mullen and Damien Chanel on sound, and our researcher Ian Kennelly. The series producer is Lorcan Clancy. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. And we leave you with Cuina na dtír uaireanta, performed by Cór Chulainn.